Welcome to A Life in Biography. This podcast is essentially a continuation or part two of a podcast I did a few weeks ago about biography in the prison house of modernism. Before I get straight to the topic, and those of you who have been listening to this podcast with any regularity know that my podcasts do tend to have digressions. I say this because I got a comment from an irate listener who was waiting to hear my exegesis of a poem by Sylvia Plath, Mirror, which I did get to in that podcast, but in a roundabout way, and that really bothered the listener to the podcast. All I can say is there's no script here. It is a kind of stream of consciousness. It's as if you're in the room with me and we're talking about biography. And as in conversations, although in this case it's in a sense a conversation with myself, though I will be bringing in some other people, not live people, but people I've been reading, there will be detours. The main point of this podcast, as the last one, is to talk about the nature of biography and how it's been truncated, reduced by a certain modern or modernist mentality. If I can put it in a nutshell, it's the idea that if you're reading a biography, it has to be, of course, about the writer's work, or why else would you write about it? But in fact, if you read, for instance, Samuel Johnson's biography of Richard Savage, now granted a minor poet, he does talk about Savage's work, but he has a statement I've quoted often about how the lives of literary figures can be filled with a kind of significance and meaning, if not quite aside from their work, can be discussed nevertheless without some kind of extensive commentary on their work. And I'm going to be getting to this in talking about biographies of Eudora Welty and of Theodore Dreiser, actually. The prison house. Of course, I'm referring to Wordsworth's famous phrase in his immortality ode about what happens to us as we grow up, that universality of childhood, of openness, gets shut down, imprisoned in a sense. And that's my attack on modernism, is the way, especially in regard to biography, it has really reduced our vision of what a biography should be. Now, what set me off on all this, actually, and I was going to do this in my first podcast on biography in the prison house of modernism, what set me off on all this was Joyce Carol Oates, who I have spoken about in other podcasts. I really don't have it in for her. It's just somehow I'm coming across things with her name on it that I feel compelled to comment on. I reviewed the book of her biographer, titled Letters to a Biographer, and that's what I'm reading from now. I'm reading from one of her letters to her biographer, actually, which is interesting in itself, the fact that he is a biographer and she writes this to him. She, at this point, she really considers him as a friend. She says, at the other evening at a dinner party, now this occurs in Princeton, a woman named Anne Waldron, something of a local character, was talking of a biography of Welty she'd just finished. Now, Anne Waldron was a great friend of mine. Anne Waldron was the author of a book about Caroline Gordon, and the Southern Renaissance. Ellen Tate figures in it, other important Southern writers. And it's about a community of writers, not so much, again, about their writing. Anne was a journalist, wrote for many years for the Houston Chronicle, wrote about children's books, was a biographer of artists. She thought of herself as a journalist, not as a literary critic, and that's important. Was Anne a local character? That's what Joyce Carol Oates calls her. Yes, Anne was very outspoken and blunt. Some people might even call her vulgar. I don't think she was a vulgar person, but she blurted out things in very amusing ways. I loved her candor. I loved her honesty. Joyce Carol Oates says in her letter, she, meaning Anne Waldron, wrote one as a biography on Caroline Gordon some years ago, which I've never read. It was very well reviewed, including in the New York Review of Books. Oates goes on, I asked her what Eudora's manuscripts were like, if she'd revised much, etc. And she said, somewhat defensively, oh, I wasn't very interested in that sort of thing. I was writing about Eudora's life. Now, that's a shocking comment to a modernist or someone trained in modernism. You would write about a writer and you wouldn't look at the writer's manuscripts? I said that, as Joyce Carol Oates says to Anne Waldron, that a writer's writing is her life. And then Waldron said a bit huffily, well, I'm a journalist, not a literary critic. Sounds like Anne. I'm not sure about the defensively part, whether she was defensive, actually. Oates goes on to say, I had the dismaying sense that she hadn't examined manuscripts at all. Later, she spoke of hinting, that's in quotation marks, that Eudora had had a love affair with Elizabeth Bowen. Ed Cohn, this is someone at Princeton, and George Pitcher, who happened to have known Bowen, questioned if this was so, and they must have been questioning Anne, because Oates goes on to say, and Anne Waldron said she hadn't any evidence. That was why she was just hinting at the possibility. Now, it depends what you mean by evidence. If you read Anne's book, there's no smoking gun in terms of an affair between Welty and Bowen, but there's a lot of, what shall we call it, circumstantial evidence, context, shall we say. Oates, this is the last sentence I'll read, this biography is under contract from Doubleday. It wasn't authorized. Eudora told friends and acquaintances not to speak with Anne Waldron. Now, I have to, as this phrase goes, declare an interest. Not only am I a friend of Anne Waldron, my wife and I convinced, persuaded, cajoled Anne into doing a biography of Eudora Welty. And I have to admit why we did this, not just because Welty was an important figure, but because at the time we were doing a biography of Susan Sontag, and we were very keen on the idea of the biographer not getting permission, writing unauthorized biographies, even of living figures, and Eudora Welty was alive at the time that Waldron began her biography, and was also... And opportunism comes into it with some biographers. Anne was looking for a big subject for whom she could get a big advance. And she got that from Doubleday. And she got Jackie Onassis as her editor. This was the plan. Anne was a Southerner. She had written about Southerners. She had written several books about Southerners. So it wasn't a stretch for her to do such a book. What was a stretch was Anne doing an unauthorized biography of a living figure. When I say it was a stretch, it was for her. When she began to run into problems, when people began to, as Oates indicated in her letter, not talk to her at Eudora's instruction, Anne was very upset. Because she had always had great cooperation with her biographies, and her biographies had always been reviewed very well. And now what you might want to call the Welty establishment was treating her as a vulgarian, as someone who didn't have the right to write about Eudora Welty. And this hurt her personally. I said to Anne at the time, why are you surprised? You know what we've encountered with Susan Sontag, hostility. I had done other unauthorized biographies, and Anne knew about all of these. And I said to her, "Anne, did you think it was just me? It was that the problem, that people wouldn't talk to me?" And she said, "Yes, it was me. I was the villain," which, you know, coming from a biographer is quite something. But she was, you know, offended, nonplussed, chagrined that these people would not talk to her. At the same time, the late Carol Kline was doing a biography of Doris Lessing, and Lessing was even more hostile maybe than Susan Sontag, calling Carol Kline, her biographer, a second-rater, etc. And Carol took it personally and was very offended. Let me pause for a minute. We'll have a drink of coffee. Well, people who have listened to my podcast, who've read any of my books or any of my writing about biography, particularly a book like Confessions of a Serial Biographer or A Higher Form of Cannibalism, Adventures in the Art and Politics of Biography, will not be surprised at my attitude or the fact that I would encourage people to write a biography of an unauthorized figure. Another friend of mine, Marion Mead, at the same time as we were doing Sontag and Anne was doing Eudora Welty, was doing Woody Allen, and he wouldn't have anything to do with her either, but Marion, pretty much like me, had a pretty thick skin, and so didn't take it personally, and didn't take against Woody at all. That was an interesting aspect of her work. Well, let's get back to this issue about a writer and a writer's work and what a biographer ought to do, and what a biography of a literary figure can be or can mean. I'm going to read to you a review that I did of another Welty biography. But I think before I do that, I want to read part of a piece that I did about W.A. Swanberg. This is in a book of mine, Essays in Biography. I'm not going to read the whole piece. It's too long. But I want to read part of it. There were very interesting reactions to Swanberg's book and Swanberg's own comments about how one does biography. Intrigued me. After I wrote the piece, I spoke to him about it. He was really gratified. I had a very positive view of his Dreiser biography, so we really hit it off. But I think he appreciated my view of how he went about doing his biography. I say in this piece, in Essays in Biography, to write a biography of a literary figure might have given trouble to a biographer with Swanberg's background. He had written about, like Anne did, journalistic figures, and he thought of himself as a journalist, certainly not a literary critic, as you'll see. How to deal with specifically literary aspects of Dreiser's life. Analysis of works of literature would have forced him into a method considerably different from his previous biographies. In part, at least, he would have to become a literary critic. And what would happen to his strong sense of narrative? Would it bog down in chapters of plot summary and interpretation, with the biographer having to conscientiously plod through both the atrocious books and the good ones? To what extent would his subject's books, some of them autobiography, tend to usurp Swanberg's own narrative? How to prevent the reader from getting mired in detailed commentary on what was true and what was not true in Dreiser's memoirs. You see, there's a whole range of issues here. In the author's note and acknowledgments, Swanberg indicates how he answered those questions. I'm reading Swanberg now. "This book is intended solely as biography, not criticism. There have been many analyses of Dreiser's works, but no attempt to study the whole man. Not even during his busiest writing years was he exclusively a writer. being always the self-taught philosopher with strong views about society. He collided repeatedly with American culture, religion, and politics. For a quarter century, he waged a violent battle against censorship of art, and his works, if not his words, had a large share in the victory. Indeed, Dreiser was a fighter incarnate, always battling something. His compulsion towards social criticism and mystic philosophy so overmastered him that he all but abandoned creative writing. If his prejudices and contradictions were awesome, the mature Dreiser represents an extreme enlargement, the confusions of the era after 1929, when intellectuals everywhere sought a better society, and when thinkers more competent than he proved as mistaken as he. But Dreiser was, in the extreme sense, an original. There has been no one like him. He deserves study simply as one of the most incredible of human beings, a man whose enormous gifts warred endlessly with grievous flaws. That's one of the things I often say about biography, quite aside from whether the person's a writer, politician, or what. There has to be an intrinsic individual interest in the individual, an intrinsic interest. Not, oh, he wrote this, this, and that, and they're really great books, and so on. That's all true. But it doesn't get to the intrinsic part. Now, I go on to say, for many literary biographers, a subject's written work is, in the main, the life, and the point is to show how the work and the like are of a piece, of the life are of a piece. Swanberg suggests that Dreiser's writing can be treated separately. Indeed, it is so treated in numerous works of literary criticism that do not deal with the whole man. But how, a literary biographer might ask, can there be a whole man in a biography that does not interpret the subject's writing? To say that there were periods when Dreiser did not write, that's what Swanberg has just said, does not seem a very convincing argument, since all authors, even the most prolific, have periods when they do not write. Other authors have been just as involved in the political and social issues of their age, and yet have also created unique personalities for themselves that surely are located in important ways in their writing. Why should Dreiser be any different? A literary biographer or critic might suspect that Swanberg has simply ducked the issue of literary biography altogether. In his review of Dreiser, this was in the New York Times Book Review, May 16, 1965. Robert E. Spiller, now he was an academic, as I recall, at the University of Pennsylvania. Robert E. Spiller suggests that a narrative of the subject's life is not enough, that somehow Swanberg has missed the heart of Dreiser by not dealing directly with his writing. Spiller does not fault Swanberg so much as suggests the biographical narrative cannot explain the creative personality. Swanberg's theory is that if we can get an accurate account of all the events and people in Dreiser's life and know what happened to him at every stage, somehow we will have gone a long way towards accounting also for his novels, short stories, poems, plays, sketches. That's Spiller speaking. Well, there was another review from Jason Epstein. He was writing in the New York Review of Books. He praised Swanberg for not writing a novelist's literary life, that often wearisome genre, with its dutiful summaries of plot and character and neat packets of themes and symbols tossed in to give the whole a savor of textbook serviceability. But by concentrating on biographical data, Mr. Swanberg has done much to elucidate the art of the man who wrote Sister Carrie and An American Tragedy, a very different view of Swanberg. And one much closer, I should say, to my own. I don't say that in this piece, but I'm saying it now. I go on in this piece to say these two reactions to Dreiser are not so much opposed as they are divided in their judgment as to where the emphasis should be placed. Spiller focuses on what Swanberg has not been able to reveal given his methodology. Epstein concentrates on the virtues of the biographer's technique, admiring how much Swanberg has accomplished while implying in a phrase, I'm quoting Epstein, done much to elucidate that has not been divulged, that not all has been divulged. Both reviewers know Dreiser's writing. Spiller would like to see more interaction between the writing and biographical narrative. Epstein is content, indeed pleased, with Swanberg's descriptions of the real-life models for Dreiser's fictional characters. With the, I'm quoting Epstein, fascinating things Epstein learns about those living creatures of Dreiser's literary production. We learn that Thelma Cutlip, whose youthful fascination ended Dreiser's career as an editor, but also embellished the portrait of Cooperwood's mistress in The Titan, married extremely well and years later took up a decorous friendship with Dreiser after her mother had committed suicide. Dreiser had portrayed Mrs. Cutlip, the mother, who had broken up the affairs, as a high-class madam. Epstein takes pleasure in making his own connections between the life and the work by drawing on the data the biographer has presented. That's what I find interesting, is how much of Swanberg's biography of a literary figure is implicit, that is implicit about what you learn about Dreiser precisely as a writer, without specifically dealing with the writing. I read Epstein again, or my characterization of Epstein. Epstein takes pleasure in making his own connections between the life and the work by drawing on the data the biographer has presented. Spiller, on the other hand, would just as soon see the biographer perform some of this work. Epstein does, however, fault Swanberg for making too little biographical use of Dreiser's fiction, especially during his middle years, when the exciting story is Dreiser's subterranean method of book planning and writing, not the parties Dreiser attended, his quarrels with publishers, or his fights with censors. That's Epstein. In other words, I'm saying, there are parts of the biography where Swanberg's external approach, which allows the pattern of his subject's actions to make the case for his internal feelings, is successful. And there are other parts where only a foray into the subject's prose itself will yield the biographical truth. While there may be an uneven quality in the biographer's structure, it is also important to recognize that the strengths and weaknesses of Swanberg's method are also apparent line by line, so to speak, as he characterizes Dreiser's life and writing without actually providing the reader with a feel for how the writing succeeds or fails. I could go on and on. I find Swanberg endlessly fascinating in what he's able to accomplish. I am going to read his passage about Sister Carrie, because what I say here is Swanberg, by not being a literary critic, Swanberg is free to reconstitute and to dramatize his subject's life. Without competition from the very text, in this case Sister Carrie, on which the biographer actually relies. So Swanberg is relying on something which he's not quoting or dissecting as a literary critic would. The impact of the biographer's prose then becomes paramount. It is as if the only way Swanberg can tell the story of Dreiser's creation of Sister Carrie is to collect and concentrate his biographical data in passages that are the culmination of the biographer's research and not of the subject's work. Let me read that again. It is as if the only way Swanberg can tell the story of Dreiser's creation of Sister Carrie is to collect and concentrate his biographical data in passages that are the culmination of the biographer's research, not of his subject's work. I'll let that sink in while I take another drink of coffee. Now, here's the passage from Swanberg that I quote. In Carrie, for the first time of importance, Dreiser translated his own experience into the desperate, hopeless yearnings of his characters. Every month, the magazine he edited had held him in a tight little straitjacket. His magazine articles were potboilers, conforming to editors' wishes. Now the reluctant conformist was free to write as he pleased about life as he saw it. He let himself go far, far into unconformity, apparently not realizing the extent of his divagation. But surely there was unconscious rebellion against the restraints that had curbed him for 4 years. Although he had read Hardy with admiration, and he was not forgetting Balzac, what came out of his pen was pure Dreiser tinctured with Spencer and evolution. He was simply telling a story much as he had seen it happen in life. He wrote with a compassion for human suffering that was exclusive with him in America. He wrote with a tolerance for transgression that was as exclusive and as natural. His mother, if not immoral herself, had accepted immorality as a fact of life. Some of his sisters had been immoral in the eyes of the world. In his own passion for women, he was amoral himself, believing that the so-called immorality was not immoral at all, but was necessary, wholesome, and inspiring, and that the conventional morality was an enormous national fraud. I just think that's a spectacular passage that would just, you know, if it had been cluttered up with quotations from Dreiser's writing, it just wouldn't have gotten us back to what I said here, which is this is a passage that's a culmination of the biographer's research, not of the subject's work. And again, I'm reading from a chapter in Essays in Biography. Originally, I wrote that piece for Dictionary of Literary Biography, and then I self-published my book, Essays in Biography. I'm going to read from another self-published book, American Biography, which is, it was a review originally published in the New York Sun in 2004, but it was partly cobbled together from a talk I gave at a conference, an American Literature conference many years ago, in which I addressed a room full of, let's call them, Weltians. Or the wealthy establishment. Precisely those people, a few of them actually were my friends because of my work on William Faulkner. I was speaking to an audience, many of whom were had refused to speak to Ann Waldron and were friends of someone else who was delivering a paper that day on that panel, Suzanne Mars, whom Eudora Welty appointed as her authorized biographer. As soon as Welty, I shouldn't say as soon as, but eventually Welty, when she knew Ann Waldron was writing about her, asked Suzanne Mars, and Mars had for years been cultivating Welty, to ask Mars to write a biography in a sense, in rebuttal or in contradistinction to Ann Waldron's Welty biography. So I'm ostensibly reviewing Eudora Welty, a biography by Suzanne Mars for the New York Sun. But as I say, this comes out of this American Literature meeting that I had, in which I wanted to confront, in a sense, the Weltians. So I say in this New York Sun review, consider this a column on the politics of biography. Some biographers make themselves, others are adopted. Suzanne Mars belongs to the latter category, which means her work has been given the imprimatur of the wealthy establishment, a confederacy of academics and literary figures gathered round the shrine of Saint Eudora. I give her that honorific because no American writer in living memory has been so adored. As Ms. Mars acknowledges, Welty projected an image of gentle integrity and humane good humor that made her seem a paragon. Now, I have to, here's one of my digressions. I'm sorry, listeners. This idea of Welty as paragon. When I was reading the new Carson McCullers biography by Mary Dearborn, I was fascinated with several references to Eudora Welty and how scathing and nasty she was about Carson McCullers. not what you would expect from a saint, shall we say. Anyway, back to my review. I give her the honorific of Saint Eudora because no American writer in living memory has been so adored. As Miss Mars acknowledges, Welty projected an image of gentle integrity and humane good humor that made her seem a paragon. She received nearly 40 honorary degrees, maybe more, Miss Mars is not sure, which get their own appendix in this biography. No anthology of American literature can do without a Welty story, such as that comic classic, Why I Live at the P.O. Only William Faulkner ranks more highly in the pantheon of Southern literature. Welty put the finishing touches to her consecration in her charming and best-selling One Writer's Beginnings. Miss Mars notes that Welty hoped to head off biographers with this memoir, as John Updike has so far, this was before there were Updike biographies, as John Updike has so far successfully done with Self-Consciousness. Certainly, that's his autobiography. Certainly, Welty made it hard for any biographer to probe deeper without seeming a spoil sport. But in Writing a Woman's Life, that was published in 1988, critic and biographer Carolyn Heilbrun questioned Welty's autobiography, wondering where was the woman who had made a literary career. If you want to know where that woman is, you ought to read about her and Catherine Ann Porter in the Carson McCullers biography. That would be my answer to Carolyn Heilbrun, who unfortunately is no longer with us. Where were the ambition, the irony, and the bitterness that mark, at least to some extent, all writers' lives? That's what's missing in the St. Eudora cult. I go on to say the sanctification had reached such a pitch in the early 1990s that a blaspheming biographer was bound to desecrate the temple. I now have to declare an interest doing that again in my review. I encouraged Ann Waldron to write the first biography of Welty, published as Eudora, A Writer's Life in 1998. Author of acclaimed biographies of Caroline Gordon and Hodding Carter, this is no blurb, check the record, Miss Waldron, a native Southerner, did a creditable job, even though she did not have full access to her subject's papers and the Welty establishment shunned her. Miss Mars dismisses Miss Waldron in a sentence. And Miss Mars is the Welty biographer I'm reviewing. Miss Mars dismisses Miss Waldron in a sentence, suggesting the biographer's attempt to humanize the mythic Miss Eudora resulted in creating an equally reductive image, the charming and successful ugly duckling. But what are Miss Mars' own bona fides, I ask? Got to stop and digress there for a moment and also take a drink of coffee. One of the things that Anne does in her book is she does talk about what Eudora Welty looks like. I don't think most people regarded her as a beauty. I'm not declaring a prejudice or a bias here. I'm just reporting the way most people looked at her. And it was Anne's premise that the way Eudora looked had something to do with the way she led her life and the way people reacted to her. Now, some people, for some reason, get outraged when a biographer does that. I did that with Lillian Hellman because so many of the women, as well as men I interviewed, talked about how spectacularly ugly they thought she was. That's what they said. And when I repeated that, because I kept hearing it, people said, one reviewer actually said, you know, Rollison, there's something wrong with Rollison. His standard of beauty seems to be Marilyn Monroe. Well, that's just bullshit. That had nothing to do with it. The fact that I had written a biography of Marilyn Monroe and Hellman didn't come up to her standard of beauty, that's just plain ridiculous. But it does show you the low standard of reviewing in this country as well. All right, back to the subject here. What are Miss Mars' own bona fides, I say? She's biographer number two. A Welty scholar, explains that she became her subject's friend during the last 15 years of Welty's life, even though she knew Welty opposed not only Miss Waldron, but also any writers attempting a Welty biography. Why did Miss Mars ask Welty's permission to write her biography? And why did Welty promptly grant the request? I say promptly there in quotation marks because those are Mars's words, that she asked Eudora Welty, and Welty said yes, right away. Silence from Mrs. Mars, that is, silence about why did Eudora say yes so promptly. Silence from Ms. Mars. Might Miss Waldron's biography, which appeared in the year Miss Mars got her go-ahead, have something to do with Welty's volte-face? What Miss Mars dare not acknowledge, what would the Welty establishment say, is that her book would have been inconceivable without Miss Waldron's valiant first effort. And what did Miss Mars discover when she was awarded complete access to the Welty sanctuary? Welty had conserved a huge amount of material. Strange doings for a biographobe. Surely this hoard should have been burned. Henry James, for example, made quite a pyre out of his papers. The only sacred texts Miss Mars was not permitted to handle were certain family letters held back until 20 years after Miss Welty's death. Do all these behind-the-scenes revelations about the biography world matter? I think they do, because they affect the biographer, her sources, and the milieu in which her book will be enshrined. This book comes ready-made with a blurb from the Welty high priest, the novelist Reynolds Price. It is not a bad book, although Miss Mars suffers from the bloat that often afflicts authorized biographers. She has relics, and she wants to show all of them. She also feels the need to comment when no comment is necessary. Thus, she reports that baby Eudora played with dolls and made up stories about them. And then I'm quoting Mars. The future story writer was at an early age engaging her imagination. To which I say, ah, I see. I have no objection to the business about the dolls. I just think that the commentary is really lame. Then there are moments when Miss Mars might comment but thinks she is only conveying amusing information. She notes, for example, that 12-year-old Eudora created for her brother Edward's entertainment her own book, complete with blurbs. Eudora created her own book, complete with blurbs. Here are the blurbs. Hear what the critics say about it. Andrew Volstead, never heard of it. Wayne B. Wheeler, I haven't read it. John Roach Stratton, I know nothing about it. It's a satire about blurbs. Just the opposite of what you expect in a blurb. And Eudora, she reminds me of the young Jane Austen. Making fun of literary conventions, in this case, including the blurb. So Eudora makes up these stupid blurbs about her own book, which don't recommend her book as blurbs are supposed to do. And then I go on to say, Miss Mars then goes on to describe Eudora in the eighth grade. She just mentions this business about the blurbs and then goes on. And I say, but hold on. Here, Welty is expressing a satirical nature of the juvenile Jane Austen. In fact, one of Welty's favorite writers. What struck me is that, like other ambitious writers, Susan Sontag comes to mind, Welty always wanted to be a writer. And it is not just that she wanted to write, she wanted to take her place in the world of publishing and of writers and critics. You know, she makes up a publication, which is what Sontag did too, and that Jane Austen did. I go on to say, spending so much time of her life in Jackson, Mississippi, Welty made it look like the world came to her. In fact, she was out there hustling like any other writer, enjoying her trips to New York City, pursuing novelist Elizabeth Bowen in London, also Catherine Ann Porter, which is mentioned in the McCullers biography, and in general, keeping her eye on the main chance as much as any other striver does. Such truths are what Miss Waldron shows us in a much more pointed fashion. Miss Mars certainly provides more facts and a much more intimate view of Welty's love life. For Weltians, this biography is indispensable. But its provenance has to be taken into consideration in order to identify the biographer's blind spots. So, I think you can understand why, when I was reading Letters to a Biographer, and Joyce Carol Oates looks sort of askance at my friend Del Waldron, why I had to talk about this. And to talk about the context of biography and its provenance, from whence it comes, and how one ought to look at biography in the total context. And it seems to me that that's exactly what modernism does not do. It tends to strip away the context. It tends to say all you need to see are the words and the lines on the page that the biographer produced. And as a biographer, I have to say no. Thanks for listening.